Hello and welcome to Enlightened Empaths, your community for the spiritually awakened, where we discuss, explore, and connect with fellow empaths, healers, intuitives, and seekers. Hello, empaths. We hope you're having a lovely start to your week. I know Denise and I are happy that spring has finally sprung. Isn't it lovely?
Oh, it is. And it comes and goes in this part of the country, but it's still, there's that glimmer that it's going to be warm and sunny and beautiful and bees and butterflies before we know it.
Oh, I can't wait. So, you know, some of the things that we often talk about and we hear and receive from listeners in email is, how do I come out of the psychic closet to my friends and family? How do I explain that I'm suddenly into crystals and Reiki and understanding that I'm an empath and learning to read tarot cards and all those things that we feel as though we need to, is defend ourselves the right word?
I think sometimes it does feel like that.
It does, doesn't it? I don't like to say that, but it does kind of feel that way. My response to all of those questions lately, Denise, has just been, yeah, you might be right about that. I have chosen non-defense as my response.
I think that's a good response, because then it can't become adversarial or having to prove yourself or, like you say, defend what your belief system is.
Yeah. And I don't want to have to defend myself, you know, and I don't want to ever place my opinion or views on someone else's belief. So I just kind of let it be. However, Denise got me a wonderful book over the holidays that we both read and really enjoyed, and we thought it would make a great topic for today's show. And it's written by Dr. David Hamilton, and it's talking about the science behind woo-woo. And there really is a lot of science to back up this metaphysical world that we are all so enamored with. So Denise and I thought it would be fun to just kind of walk through some of the evidence that Dr. Hamilton points to in this book.
And that's what's really fun for those of us that are very empathic, but also have that logical side. And we may catch ourselves double guessing, or I don't know, or this sounds kind of crazy. When you can get some factual evidence, and there's been research studies, and there have been things done over decades of time that validate why there's a reason we do what we do and feel connected to things, I absolutely love that.
I do too. You know, one of the first things he talks about in that book is proof of something called kindness hormones. Had you ever heard that before?
Not in those words, no.
Me neither. And I really liked it. He talks about how we all have these stress hormones, which I think we're well aware of, and we don't need any science to back that up. But he says we also have kindness hormones. And he says just as feelings of stress produce stress hormones, kindness has its own biological products. They're produced by feelings just as stress hormones are. And he says the main hormone produced when we're focused on kindness is oxytocin, which is often nicknamed the love drug or the hugging hormone or the cuddle chemical. And as we know, oxytocin works to strengthen and protect the cardiovascular system. It lowers blood pressure and reduces inflammation. And Hamilton says that this helps prove that positive feelings increase happiness and build resilience and protect against depression. They impact brain function and even cause neurological changes if they're experienced over a period of time. They also reduce inflammation and even help us live longer. So he provides a lot of studies and a lot of science and a lot of statistics that my eyes kind of glossed over, but you guys can check it out when you read his book. But he really does show through these studies that when we are kind, or when we receive kindness, and here's the cool thing, if we just think about a time when someone was kind to us, or when we were kind to someone, just thinking about it helps increase these kindness hormones. He says that both positive and negative feelings can be induced in a real situation or an imagined one. Just as your brain doesn't distinguish between a real stressful event and an imagined one, it's the same with kindness. So when we just think kind thoughts about other people, or just think about when people were kind to us and vice versa, science now shows that this is a simple yet effective way of reducing stress.
We've had this come up in different episodes and in conversations. When you do something kind and benevolent, especially anonymously, you feel good. You feel better. And I never thought about there being a kindness little thing that was released at that time, but it makes perfect sense.
It really does. And I think what's important too for empaths to remember is we have to let people be kind to us. Now, that might sound like a strange statement, but I don't know about you, Denise, but I'm so used to doing it on my own or, no, I'm good, thank you. And I'm much more comfortable being the giver of kindness than receiving the kindness. And after reading a lot of these studies about how kindness does help us to feel so much better, more positive, I think it's a good reminder to say yes when help is offered.
Well, that came through with some writing I was doing the other day, and I thought about it of, you know, we give, we want to be of service, we want to help other people, but we're at this place now where we also have to say, how can I receive as well as just give? And that's what you're saying as well, is that we have to get that balance in place if we're going to continue to give and support others at the volume that we do. And as empaths, that's our default position, is to help, to be of service, to want to make it okay for folks. But we are taking it away from someone else when we don't receive.
Yeah, and it's the littlest things. It just happened to me yesterday. I was just sitting out on my front steps with my dog, flipping through my mail, and the UPS driver came up. And so, of course, my little Lily, I have a little Yorkie. She's a tough 7-pound tiny dog. And believe she can take on the UPS truck, let me tell you. So she runs right out in front of it. And the poor guy has to slam on his brakes. And then, of course, she takes off because, you know, she's not that tough. And so he's like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I was like, no, I'm so sorry. Like, she was just sitting out here while I checked the mail. And he's like, let me help you look for her. And I was like, no, I got it. And he reaches into his pocket and he goes, I got a biscuit. And like, my dog, if anyone out there has little dogs, you'll understand. I've always had big dogs, so it took me a long time to figure this out. Little dogs do not take just any treat you give them. No. So I knew this treat he pulled out, she was never going to eat. And I was like, no, it's fine. I got it. I know you guys are so busy. And he looked so deflated, Denise.
Oh.
And I was like, you know what? I think that's her favorite dog treat. Do you mind if I use that to coax her back in and then you can go on and finish your rounds? And he was like, no, not at all. That's why I bring that. He was so happy. And I thought, you know, Samantha, stop being so damn independent. Like, just say yes.
Yeah.
It made him happy. It made me happy. And, you know, I got Lily back in the house.
Win-win all the way around.
It's a really tiny, insignificant example, but it was just the first one that popped into my head. But even like if you're stressed out and people are like, oh, can I bring you dinner? Oh my gosh. I'm always like, no, I'm fine. I got DoorDash. I think it's important to say, yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Right. That's an uphill battle for a lot of us, I think.
I know.
But we can always grow and evolve.
What was one of your favorite parts of the book?
Well, the nature stuff, of course, because that's kind of my thing. And I'm going to kind of go on a ramble with this because, you know, it's so part of who I am and what I believe. But, you know, as empaths, you know, why do so many of us have such a strong need and desire to be connected with nature and the natural world? If you think about it, that was our default over the millions of years of evolution. And it's only in recent history that people are more acclimated to a man-made environment rather than being in the natural surroundings. And when you think about stress being so linked to so many health complications and lifestyle choices in this day and age, but our ancestors experienced more infrequent bouts of stress because it was more easily regulated of the parasympathetic activity of the automatic nervous system, you know, that rest and digest portion. But nowadays, the sympathetic stimulation of fight or flight is what most of us live with in this fast-paced world. It's always constant, go, what's next? How do I check the phone? I had a few days recently where I had no cell reception. There, where I was located, there was nothing. and I was in the middle of nowhere, and it took a minute to acclimate to that. And then this sense of peace descended that, I mean, there's an unsettling feeling. And then I, you know, being of a certain chronological age, most of my life being on instant speed dial wasn't an option. And we've all acclimated to that in this fast-paced world that we're in now, and has increased stress, but it's also, I believe, having an impact on our nervous system. So as, you know, stress, I think for many, myself included, can become a habit. But our nervous system has evolved to relax automatically when we find ourselves in natural settings. And Dr. Hamilton cites several studies that show we respond rapidly to natural environments faster than even negative association and memories can override them. So this psychological response is so fast, and that indicates that our preference for a natural environment is innate. It's something we're all born with. So, I mean, we all know, oh, I feel so relaxed when I go out into nature. And as you mentioned, there are so many studies. And if you like science, which I do like science, but little things of Mandelbrot was a Sterling professor of mathematical sciences at Yale. And he brought up that term fractal. And his work showed that all the natural things in the world appear rough, but there's always a simple repeating pattern. And that nature develops in fractal patterns, whereas human-made things, buildings, cars, and everything else aren't. They're just, they're straight lines or blocky shapes. And that's not what resonates with us on an energetic level. And there, a lot of research now is saying that are a lot of mental health problems rooted in the fact that we live in this artificial world most of the time. What do you think?
Oh, I think that is so true. And I think also the type of nature might be different for each of us. I don't think it's all nature. Do you know what I mean? Like, some of us need to be among the trees. Some of us need to be by the ocean. Some of us might need to be hiking on up a mountain. Some of us might need to be doing something active in nature, like kayaking or rafting. I think the type of nature that resonates with you as an individual empath is going to be different, and that's okay.
And it can be as simple as a green patch in a city park. It doesn't have to be. But, you know, all the complementary medicine is treatment that takes place in a restorative setting and one that promotes rest and rejuvenation, which seems to be a topic for many, many people right now. How we had that in our in the show we did recently on Help I Can't Relax. And think about forest bathing. You go into the woods and it takes your body from this stressed, overwhelmed, and overstimulated place to that natural rested state. And that's what we're hoping to achieve. I mean, they've done studies on people who were in recovery from surgery when they were able to even look out the window at a natural setting versus a blank wall, that their recovery was faster, their mental health, their physical health, they needed fewer. And when they've put plants inside of a recovery room, that people needed fewer analgesics for pain. They had lower blood pressure and heart rate, less anxiety and fatigue. So even that healing of the plant energy in a recovery room when people have had surgery, and the fact that they could find specific measures to show there was a difference. And that's what I love about this book, is that it's not just, well, I think it works, so it works. There was a 5-year project done in the UK called Eco Minds, and it's based on the concept of ecotherapy, of improving mental and physical health and well-being by supporting people to be active outdoors. And they, you know, just exercising, whether it's walking in nature or running, riding a bicycle, kayaking, all the things you mentioned. And we've done shows and we've talked about healing, the power of healing and sound healing is where I was going with that. And the sounds of nature, so many of us get that same response from listening to calming music. So when you listen to music, that relaxing, soft music, it may be put you into a theta state. It may not. But you have to wonder, is the use of relaxing music because we are evolved to that, that that hits a different part of our brain than it would have our ancestors. But they have shown that patients with coronary heart disease, when they've listened to relaxing music, it showed an overall reduction in anxiety, heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure, and even quality of sleep after they went through surgery. But the biggest part of this was when they, for me, they talked about the importance of empathy can heal. And think about how your body reacts when any medical or other type of practitioner takes the time to listen, to smile, to be kind, and how that stimulates a patient's natural healing process. So I think all of this, the physical, mental, and spiritual reaction we have to being in nature is hardwired into our DNA.
Oh, but, I agree. I was fascinated by his chapter on telepathy and how he said it's empathy that is the connection between telepathy in terms of all the scientific studies. And that's something you and I stress when we teach our mediumship classes. We always talk about how compassion is the key.
Yes.
And I thought this was interesting. So he says empathy, compassion, and love are the connection. And in all the prayer studies and the distant healing studies that he cited, the distant healing and the prayer worked when people had some kind of empathic connection with who they were sending the prayer or healing energy to. And so I thought, remember when he showed the study that some, you know, there's always that, you know, that third grader in your class who was like, there's no Santa Claus. Well, those people grow up and they take all of the grant time and money to prove that prayer doesn't work. So he uses one of those studies and he compared it with another study showing that prayer doesn't work. And the difference was in the study where prayer didn't work, there was no empathic connection between who they were praying for. It was like, you're going to pray for patient A. But when people were shown like a picture or a name or a history, like, hey, this is a father of two who's going in for a triple bypass, and here's what he looks like, that energy worked. And I found that fascinating because it shows that we are all connected.
Right. And that ties in with the whole consciousness thing. And the chapter on consciousness in this book, I had to read through it 3, 4, 5 times because there's so much in it. But that was another thing. And so many people right now are using, choosing, or there's a lot of interest in ayahuasca, psilocybin, other psychoactive substances to increase consciousness. So we'd be kind of remiss if we didn't mention it in this, and it is brought up in the book. But, and we aren't obviously promoting or negating this impact or the modality, but just kind of bringing it into the topic. One of the things that they bring up is that it all comes down to a consciousness that we may consider a label as our connection with spirit or the collective consciousness. Is it locked in the head of the individual, or is there in fact a connection between people shown with our subtle connections with nature? Or, and this again comes up, even that compassionate prayers for other people help. So, you know, you can get into the mainstream science showing the philosophy of materialism is a more practical view that consciousness is a product of the interactions between neurons in the brain. And that's all it is, and there's nothing else. And that goes back to that third grader that doesn't believe in Santa Claus. But you know, pain is a good example. If you fall and get hurt and you feel pain, it's the transmission of signals along bundles of nerve fibers that activate specific brain centers. So that's one mindset, is that it is just, it's material, that's what it is. Another viewpoint is that it's illusionary, that, you know, this is an illusion, you're making it up in your head. But the third perspective is more dualist, that the physical and matter and consciousness both exist, but they're separate entities, like the idea of a body and a separate soul. That's kind of where I lean. I think it's all, we're in this body for a reason, and we are going to physically have our neurons light up when we experience pain. But we're also able to connect with that healing of divine if we can shift our consciousness. And some people do that with substances. Some people do that with meditation. Some people do that with prayer. I think it all gets to the same place in varying degrees.
Yeah, I do too. And I definitely think consciousness exists outside of the body. I believe in the filter brain conscious theory, where the brain is filtering what the consciousness is always receiving and picking up, and the brain can only filter through its limited five senses. So I do think the consciousness is eternal and it's connected to our soul. And I think it's what makes all of this woo-woo work.
Well, I was talking with someone recently, and we were discussing how intuitive stuff, when you're intuitive and something comes to you, are you projecting the thought and then it's coming back to you, or are you receiving something that's coming in from someone else? So the example of, I was thinking of a good friend, I hadn't seen them in a long time, and then all of a sudden they passed me in traffic and we connected, and but they had crossed my mind and boom, there they are. So are you putting out the thought, or are you perceiving the thought of them, that they're coming into your energetic field? So that is fascinating. But then the conversation went from that of the intuitive, are you perceiving or receiving, to when you take it up to the next level of that more collective of guides, of angels, of ancestors, or whatever, have you tapped into that next level of consciousness that is bringing it down? And are you're also perceiving and receiving?
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's both.
I agree.
And I also sometimes wonder if it isn't as simple as the strongest energy wins. Like if somebody is really, really stressed out, picture that as a physical thing. So it's like ripples of energy going through this web of the collective unconscious. And if someone is intuitive, meaning more right-brained and more open to receiving signals from the collective unconscious, that strong ripple of energy, if you have a heart-corded connection with them, you're going to pick it up.
Right.
I think it's all interconnected and woven. But, you know, there could be some genetic thing to this as well, or evolutionary thing, because Dr. Hamilton mentions a lot of studies done by Rupert Sheldrake. He's the amazing man who did all those dog studies. Do you remember those? Like how the dogs could sense when their person was coming home, even if they used a different car or a different route or came home at a different time. I love those studies. Anyway, he mentioned another study where Sheldrake says women might be better at telepathy and intuition, simply because women throughout the eons needed to be able to read the nonverbal cues of their infants. And so this need also increased women's empathy. And so together, the combination has strengthened women's overall intuition.
Wow.
I mean, I never really thought about that.
Right.
But that could be true. And as cultures and society and all of us have evolved, maybe that's just been passed on. And that's why they always say woman's intuition, which personally, that always kind of bugs me, that phrase. You know, because there's a lot of men out there who are incredibly intuitive and wonderfully psychic, but whatever.
We're moving in a new direction with that. And we're realizing that it's people and it's innate. I did hear, this is kind of an offshoot, but not really. I was driving a long distance recently, and I was listening to this podcast on the way back, and there was this person telling a story, and the man was talking about how as a child, he really struggled in school because he either knew the stuff and was bored, or it just made absolutely no sense to him. And he had a really hard time with interactions and was in trouble a lot and all these things. And he ended up, I don't even think he graduated. I think he left high school and didn't graduate, but this was back like quite a long time ago. But he was really, really good with machines and equipment, and he loved music. And this was back in the, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s. And he ended up working with bands as a sound tech. But he was the guy who ended up inventing the pyrotechnics that with like when Kiss and all the big rock and roll bands had fire coming out of their instruments, he was the guy that helped develop that. So he got really good at sound effects and special effects and all this stuff. And a company, Lucasfilms, reached out to him, and he was so overwhelmed with the thought of, I don't have the education to support this. I don't have the background. I can't. I'm going to make a fool out of myself. I'm not going to go. And he switched careers and ended up working on high-end automobiles like Bentleys and Rolls Royces and Land Rovers. And he said, I could just listen and I could hear what was wrong with the, he said, I had an intuitive connection with machines, but not with people. And he did this Harvard study where they were trying to give him this therapy treatment so that he could learn to read people's emotions. And he did the whole treatment and they showed him pictures and they asked him, is this person frustrated or happy? And he said, blank, couldn't do it. He was diagnosed with autism as an older adult. And that was why. But the point of the story is when he was driving home, he started listening to some music and he felt the music for the first time. So the therapy they did reacted with the way he was wired, but it was just a different form of making a connection with empathy and compassion and understanding. And he said he still struggles with reading people, but he can always read machines and technology and music.
Wow.
And I just thought it was just fascinating to listen to. And but he said, going back to what you said about, you know, the women being more, you know, having a natural propensity towards, he said that the people at this, when they were doing this work, said one in 30 people who may have been born biologically male tend to have that chemistry to relate more to machine, to linear, to technology than to people. I was very, very interesting to me.
I like stories like that because it reminds us that each and every one of us has a unique purpose and gift to share with the world. And the world might tell us, you know, oh, you don't fit in or you don't have a whole lot to offer. And we might, you know, we always have a choice. We can listen to that and stay down, or we can keep doing our own thing and our unique light and find our way. And look what he did.
Right. And he didn't fit in and he never felt like he was smart enough or good enough or he limited. And then he went into that world with the music world and they didn't care. They just cared that he could make their guitars do what they wanted them to do and could make their music sound wonderful. And he could do that. But then I think if we don't fit the mold, whether it's emotionally or spiritually or educationally, realizing exactly what you just said is that it doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means that it's different and it's the way that it works for you. And I think that was supported in this book.
I do too. Before we run out of time, can I share my notes on crystals?
That's exactly what I was going to say next. It is so sick. And it's right here in front of me, the notes. And I was thinking, oh no, that would just be morally wrong not to bring up the connection with crystals.
You know, it's so funny. I didn't take any notes on the chapter on nature because I knew you would do that one. I was like, nope. Okay, so he talked a lot about crystals and how they have been shown to help plants grow. Now, I feel like I always knew this, but I didn't know the science behind it. He says that quartz sends the Earth's magnetic field, the GMF, around itself. It kind of like bends it, kind of like the way an umbrella bends the path of rain as it falls around us. And just as our umbrella sends more rain onto someone standing beside us who doesn't have one, a diagnetic substance essentially passes the GMF over, increasing how much it is felt by something in the vicinity. So because plants are tuned to the GMF and quartz is like that umbrella of the GMF, it gives more energy to the quartz. And he did his own study with this. He took some seeds and he watered some of the seeds with water, and he watered the other half of the seeds with water that had been infused with rose quartz. And it showed that the seeds watered with the rose quartz water grew 30% taller.
That's significant.
That is significant. So crystals really do work. And I wanted to mention, because he talked briefly about laser crystals. And so I just wanted to tell listeners, if they haven't heard of someone and they are interested in crystals too, Marcel Joseph Vogel was an IBM scientist who did some fascinating work with crystals. He had over 100 patents in phosphor technology, liquid crystal systems, luminescence, magnetics, just to name a few. And in the 1970s, Vogel did some pioneering experiments showing how quartz crystals can amplify, store, focus, transfer, and transmute energy. He said crystals ground human energy and bring the mind to an alpha state. When the left and right brain merge, we are home. And so he did a lot of interesting research. His IBM lab, he had basically carte blanche. Like they just, I guess they were enamored with him and his brain, and they let him kind of do whatever he wanted. And so before he started working with crystals, he did these energy of love experiments where he positioned two squares of grass on either end of the lab. And each day he would direct loving thoughts for about an hour to one of the squares of grass using prayer and thought. And the other patch of the grass, he just completely ignored. After 1 month of the process, the grass receiving the love grew at a rate of 35% more than the grass that was ignored. So he even replicated this experiment with the patch of grass located 8,000 miles away and got similar results showing that love is not bound by time or location. And Denise, it's this work and this research that inspired Dr. Emoto to do his work with water crystals.
Oh.
I know. I didn't know that. So I found this story about how Vogel started working with crystals on a website called crystallightandsound.com. So check this out. It says that Marcel was giving a talk in Northern California when he was approached by a woman after his presentation, and she handed him a quartz crystal. When he asked her, you know, why do you want me to have the crystal? She said, you need to work with it. He returned to his lab, and the next day, a lab assistant complained of a backache. So Marcel thought about that crystal the woman had given him. He grabbed it, drew a deep breath, and when he released his breath while holding the crystal aimed at the coworker recoiled and fell to the floor in an altered state of consciousness. Right. First of all, I want to say that is some crystal, because I've done a lot of like crystal chakra work on people and I've never had that response. But anyway, the woman called back after a few weeks to inquire about the progress with the crystal, only to hear Marcel describe how the crystal had somehow vanished. She told him she would send another, but shared that the crystal would not allow itself to be used without reverence or respect. So Marcel began working with crystals at this point. Until the day he experienced a vision upon waking from his sleep. He says he had this vision that lasted for over 30 minutes, where Marcel saw the Talmudic tree of life in geometric form, which he felt was a little strange since he wasn't Jewish, but he still managed to grab a notepad and draw some diagrams from this vision. This led him to spend the next year in his IBM lab making his first four-sided healing wand in that shape based on the geometric shape he held and saw in his vision. This led to the creation of the Vogel crystal. So I don't know if any of you guys have heard of a Vogel crystal. They have to be very specifically cut. Are you ready for some specifics, Denise?
Yes, please.
All right. In order for a crystal to be a true Vogel, it must be cut in such a way that it takes in energy at the receptive end, amplifies it as it circulates around inside, hitting the internal sides of the polished side facets as it revolves, and then is transmitted from the focal end. So it has to be natural quartz that's double terminated or cut and polished to be double terminated, and it has to be cut completely aligned with the C axis of the quartz crystal. The receptive end, called the female end of the crystal, must be faceted, forming an internal angle of 51 degrees, 51 minutes, 51 seconds. This is the same angle as the sides of the Great Pyramid at Giza. And it has to have four or more side facets. The transmitter, the male end of the crystal, must be faceted with a more acute internal angle than the receptive end. So working with crystal, Vogel learned that by pointing a crystal at another person, the crystal would amplify the person's thoughts and emotions. He said crystals are working with an energy in the unlimited dimension of a magnetic domain. Crystals are a radio transmitter, a memory element, a transceiver, and a computer that delivers small doses of natural radiation to the body. Crystals agitate the water in the body using a natural element. So I have a Vogel crystal replica. There are only 3 or 4 highly reputable certified Vogel crystal creators in America. And about a 1-inch Vogel starts at about $800.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And usually when you go to these men's, the ones that I have found that are highly reputable are all men. When you go to their website, it's pretty cool, Denise, because it'll say, like, fill out this form, you know, with your intention. It'll take me about 3 to 4 months to complete it, and I'll mail it to you. So they are cut to you and your spec. Isn't that cool?
It is.
Yeah. So I definitely want to get one. I got one that is just made by someone who's not certified in it. And I still love it and treasure it, but I do want a Vogel certified crystal.
So that's interesting, because it's not, you would never find one naturally. It has to be altered by a person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, I could do a whole show on Vogels. So I know we're running short on time, but some of the experiments that he did are pretty interesting about how you can go like counterclockwise with the Vogel, pointing with the female end. So it pulls the pain out of the body. And then you can go clockwise over a point of pain on a body to bring more light into that area. Two people can have a Vogel and try to do, you know, typical ESP things like choosing the, what are those called? Zener cards. And supposedly those results are amplified when you have a Vogel. I don't know. I haven't participated in any of those, but I think it's cool to think and read about.
It is. And because so many of us are connected, and you're more of an expert, you know this, you've lived with crystals for many, many decades as being an integral part of your life and your work. And then there are some of us that just, oh, this one feels right to me, or I always hold this one when I'm feeling stressed. I spoke with someone recently who, you know, sleeps holding a crystal and usually will wake up and the crystal has fallen aside, but woke up during a kind of stressful time and was still holding that crystal all night. So the fact that you brought through this science that supports, that Hamilton brought through this science that supports why they actually work. One last thing that I think would be really, really helpful is you had some beautiful notes on why Reiki works. And I know a lot of our listeners, I always refer to Reiki as a gateway drug, that it seems to open the door to so many other modalities for people. But would you mind taking a minute and just like briefly sharing why Reiki is also the science of that works?
Yes. I was so happy he had a whole chapter on that too. So for anyone who's listening and they're like, Ray, what? Reiki is a form of hands-on healing that was rediscovered in the early 20th century by a teacher named Dr. Usui after he climbed Mount Karuma to meditate for 21 days. The word Reiki derives from two words that when combined mean universal life force energy. So it involves a practitioner who's been attuned to Reiki using gentle hands-on touch in combination with Reiki symbols to facilitate a greater flow of universal life force energy into the client's aura, chakras, and overall energy system. And I just want to pause for a second and say, you always want to make sure when you choose a Reiki teacher that you ask what their Reiki lineage is, because every Reiki master should be able, in a few quick steps of teachers, to trace their lineage back to Dr. Usui. So I just want to say that's one good way to find a reputable Reiki teacher is say, can you email me your lineage? Okay. Now, what's cool is that so many hospitals are now offering Reiki volunteers who are able to do Reiki sessions on patients. And this has resulted in several studies which show that Reiki helps reduce inflammation, pain, blood pressure, anxiety, and depression. One study showed that patients who received Reiki for 60 to 90 minutes while in the hospital requested less pain medicine compared with patients who did not receive Reiki. In Why Woo-Woo Works, Dr. Hamilton refers to dozens of studies done with women recovering from hysterectomies or patients dealing with stage 4 cancers or others who'd undergone total knee replacements. All of the studies reported a significant reduction in pain after receiving Reiki. He also mentions a 2019 British Medical Journal study that said Reiki therapy is useful for relieving pain, decreasing anxiety, depression, and improving overall quality of life in several conditions. Now, in that chapter, Hamilton defines Reiki this way. He says, Reiki is classified as a biofield energy therapy, as are therapeutic touch, pranic healing, Qigong, and others. While the term biofield might sound woo-woo, it's simply an electric or magnetic field of energy or information that's produced by a biological organism. There's a simple way to visualize the way Reiki and other biofield energy therapies work. Take a plate of hot food. It gives off heat. The temperature of the environment around the plate is correlated with the temperature of the food, and that's why the air close to the food feels warm. But if we altered the temperature field around the food, it would impact the food itself. So we could cool the food by cooling the environment around it, or we could make it warmer by placing it in a hot environment. In these biofield energy therapies, the idea is to work with the energy field that surrounds the human body in the understanding that it's correlated with the body's internal state. Changes in the biofield are therefore believed to induce changes in the human body that produces the field. Now, I'd never heard Reiki or any of those other types of healing modalities explained that way.
But it brings it into perspective and it makes perfect sense. And for if you were with someone who was doubting or saying, what do you mean you're just going to channel energy and it's going to help someone feel better? This gives you an actual reason why it works.
Yeah, it really does. All of those things, I was so skeptical about. I remember the first time someone got me a gift certificate for a cranial sacral therapist. Have you ever had a cranial sacral massage?
Yes, very different. Very unique feeling.
I'm laying there and she's like barely touching my head. And I'm like, what is this? And it's, you know, it's expensive for a session. And I felt bad for my friend who got this for me. And I was like 10 minutes in going, this is nothing. Like, I'd rather a massage. An hour later, the lady's tapping me awake. Denise, I never fall asleep, ever. I don't nap. I don't fall asleep on planes, trains, or automobiles. Like, I'm not that person who just nods off. I went back to her several times. I never stayed awake for a whole session. I don't know what she did, but she definitely got rid of, I was having hip pain after giving birth, got rid of that. And it was the most relaxing thing I've ever experienced. So I definitely think these biofield energy therapies work, maybe because of what he's saying, that it works in our auric field.
It's so interesting to me. And again, just the fact of you can believe, and we believe in these practices. We use these practices. You have, you know, crystals are an intricate part of your life. Nature is an integral part of my life. Just that, all of those things. But when you can get something to back it up, that's a good feeling.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is, because we all need to know that we're on the right path. And I think when we live in such a technological, I mean, did you see what Elon Musk just did with the brain implant and the person who's, I mean, it's amazing how we're becoming kind of part AI our own selves, right?
Yeah, it kind of wigs me out, I have to be honest.
Well, it kind of does me too, but that's another show. But it's, we live in such a world of technology. And I think for people like us who live in such a world, I feel like I have a foot in both worlds sometimes. You know, there's like this invisible world where I feel so many things that other people aren't admitting to or acknowledging or even on a conscious level recognizing. And then we as empaths point it out, or I don't know, it can be very disconcerting to be aware of the invisible world as much as you are of the visible techno electronic Wi-Fi world. And having books like this that bridge the gap is comforting.
And if you do have a geeky side, not saying that any of us do, but if you do, the references in the back of this book are incredible. Every chapter has pages of references that are cited. So if you have a certain part of the book that you're like, oh, this is written for me, you can also go back and just get so much more information and resources and validation, which I think is a nice thing as well.
I do too. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this little trek down science class lane. And we wish you a beautiful, wonderful, magical week in both the visible and the invisible world. Please remember, as always, to show up, do great work, and share your light.
Take care.